Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Main Course without Patrick Martins on Heritage Radio Network. I am your host, Alexis McLaughlin, and I'm very excited to have in studio today Wolfgang Bonn of Eddie and the Wolf and of the new brew pub, Paulaner, or Paul...
Paulana.
I can't do the German thing. That's I can't okay. do any language thing.
Good morning, Alexis. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Before we dive in to talk about your spots, I want to tell you guys a little bit about an upcoming event that we're really excited to be doing. Heritage Foods USA and Loop Osteria Romano, one of Mario Batali and Joe Bastianich's early spots. We're doing an upcoming event. It's going to be a lunch tasting. Three breeds of animals. So basically we're doing some lamb, pork and chicken, and we're going to taste four different it's very confusing. So it's just going to be like a meat tasting extravaganza on June 28th. Our farmers are coming in. We're going to have Frank Reese there. He's a poultry farmer. We're going to have Craig Good there with his wife Amy Good, and we're also going to have Ben and Grace Mackin, who are lamb farmers in Vermont. So if you guys are interested, go ahead and shoot us an email at info@heritagefoodsusa for a bit more information. It's plastered all over social media right now, but it should be really great. Tickets are, I think, $145 a person, and it covers, you know, the whole four-course tasting. Should be a really special event. We look forward to hopefully seeing you guys out there. Chef Jason Denton is really... putting together something special, but that's it. That's my plug starting out with, and yeah, Wolfgang, thank you. Hi, welcome.
Hello.
So I actually was stopped by the other night. I still can't pronounce the name. Paulana. It sounds like Pollyanna a little bit.
Well, it's named after a brewery in Germany, which has almost 400 years of history. It was founded by monks who came from northern Italy, from Paolo, and then that's why they called him Paulana.
Yeah.
So those were the monks from Paolo.
And it, you know, the interesting thing about this spot, it's in the Bowery, but it is itself a microbrew and a restaurant. Like, you guys are brewing beer on site.
We are a microbrewery. We are affiliated with Paulana, but we have nothing really in common. Mm-hmm. Besides that, our brewmaster, Andreas, who worked for Paulana for 15 years, basically had all his education at the brewery, but he's using his own recipes, and we are proud of his recipes.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. To see, you know, a microbrew in New York City, you know, in the space, like, and putting out, what is it, five beers and a seasonal?
No, we usually have four traditional standard beers and then always one seasonal.
Yeah.
So we have a Hefeweizen, which is the number one Paulana brew in Munich. Obviously his recipe, and he's changing it throughout the seasons, so he makes them a little bit lighter and fresher in summer, mm-hmm. and a little heavier and richer in winter. We always have a lager. We have a dark one, a Dunkel, and since we're in America, since we're in New York City, we also have an IPA,
which is not traditional, but it was delicious.
Thank you very much.
What does it mean top fermenting hops?
Well, there are two groups, basically, two peer groups. There's the top fermented and the bottom fermented. The top fermented is also called the ale family. So IPA would be in the ale family, Hefeweizen would be in the ale family, and the bottom fermented ones are the lager family.
Okay, and lager, because that's fermented at cooler temperatures for longer durations?
Exactly. Lager usually takes about 3.5 to 4 weeks versus the ale family is about 2 weeks.
Yeah, so depending on how impatient you are.
Exactly.
when you want your beer. Did you know about beer this much about beer before going into this venture? Because it seems like a lot to you know, you come from, you know, an executive chef position, you know, working with, you know, traditional, you know, German food, but where, you know, I know beer is a component, but going into a venture where now it's like actually a functioning microbrew, I feel like you got to have, you know, some really good knowledge there, or be working with some really trustworthy people.
Well, my background, I'm coming from Austria, from the very eastern part called Burgenland, which is a wine region. So my whole family was in the wine business. I grew up with my grandfathers. I helped them crush the grapes while I was a little boy, and then later on I was harvesting the grapes. So this was really what I grew up with and where my patient was. And throughout the first couple of years, it was always like food and wine, and I put all my time and my energy into those two things. And about a year and a half ago, I got affiliated with Paulana, and so I spent a lot of time with Andreas, our brewmaster, and started learning about beer, like the different brews and the different brands, hops, malts, and what it does to the beer. And I have to say it's quite interesting. Yeah. I'm really enjoying it.
I think the thing that I really enjoyed the most with the beers, they all tasted, they had this like common thread throughout. I guess it would be like kind of like they were all in the same family. They were all distinctly different, they, you know, their own style. But they all seemed related the way, like, you know, siblings and cousins kind of were. Like, there was just, like, this nice, like, common thread. It was a nice consistency. I think it's that that more yeast forward, kind of that banana flavor with the Hefeweizen that you get. But it carried nicely through, even to the IPA. I don't know, it was unique. It was just something different, something enjoyable.
Well, I think you can definitely see that it's a European brewmaster versus an American brewmaster. And he clearly grew up with a different flavor profile when it came to beer. And so even when you taste the IPA and you compare it to IPAs, usual American IPAs, it's much softer, it's much more, I would almost say has more a feminine touch than most of the American IPAs.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the tenets of German beer, you know, as I understand it, is, you know, Germans make a very drinkable beer, you know, something like you can really enjoy, like it's not overly aggressive. It is a little bit soft, a little rounder. I was really surprised there's no spices, no fruit, no additives in brewing, but it really had a nice, like, kind of warm, spiced sort of, you know, feel to it. And it was a little bit, it just, you know, just like a rounder, richer tone.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is also that he's playing around with a lot of different hops. And you're probably familiar with that, but there is the American hops, which are grown here in the U.S., versus the European hops. They are quite different. So he always tries to use a mix of different hops, even when he does an IPA. Obviously, the IPA, the hop content in the IPAs is like 4 times higher than in a lager or in a Hefeweizen. And so he tries to give it his touch and still, like, does a little mix to bring out the hoppiness, which you need in an IPA, but still have a little bit of that European touch.
Yeah. Well, it works well, complements the food nicely, although I guess that's, you know, that's kind of the history of the food as well. They came up together.
Thank you.
We want to talk a little bit about, you know, developing, you know, what you wanted, what the vision was for the space, because it's, you know, it's very, it seems very traditional beer garden, but, you know, that is American beer garden the same as, you know, Bavarian beer garden would be, or is our idea of a beer garden, you know, Americanized, as I would imagine?
Well, I think beer garden, for me, beer garden, or for people in Germany, and I would say for people in the U.S. or in New York, it's the same thing. It's a huge space. It's a place where families and friends come together, and this is kind of what we wanted to create. I took over Paulana after it was already in operation for about 3 months, and I decided I wanted to make a change of interior, and so I closed it down for another 2 months and changed the whole design and tried to give it a little bit of a warmer feeling, a more rustic feeling, but definitely more communal. We created out of reclaimed wood, 150-year-old wood from North Carolina. We created those massive communal tables, which can sit up to 20 people. And then we also have like beautiful like booths on the side of the room. And I think this is important when you go to a beer garden. Even if you come by yourself or in a small group, you want to be together with a lot of different people who all enjoy the same thing, good food and good beer.
Yeah, that is really the staple of the beer garden, I guess, is most important, you know, is the atmosphere in the community, you know, sitting all together kind of loud and just having fun. I was really excited. The first thing that I went looking for on the menu was pork knuckle, of course, because that is just like the most typical beer garden, for me, you know, at least experience I can imagine. Is that something that's hard to, you know, introduce people to, or do you find like, you know, American, you know, diners are like familiar enough? Because that's not really, you know, a choice cut.
Well, I would say it's it has a growing popularity. In the beginning, it was a little bit more difficult, but we're open now for a little bit more than a year, and I see more and more people, especially on the weekends when you have a larger group, when you have friends coming together. It might be a little bit difficult when you have like 90 degrees outside temperature to order a pork knuckle, which is first of all pretty large and then and also very rich. But I mean, for fall or for winter, I think it's a perfect dish for a beer garden.
Absolutely.
The skin on the outside and the bone in the middle, which the skin holds everything together, the fat and the juiciness.
The skin is the important part, because that's what gets crispy.
Exactly.
That's like the, you know, the crackling, the crunch, and just holds all the fat juices inside, and everything just kind of melts together. It's like, you know, it's like it's self-contained, like a little baking dish.
Exactly. But it's also quite difficult to get the skin like softened and crackling at the same time.
Enough to be able to get through it. How long do you have to cook it for?
Well, I mean, we cook it in two stages. I mean, the first part is we submerge it in fat and just poach it to really soften up the skin. And then the second step is very, very high temperature, and then 40 minutes in the oven to really like break up the skin and dry it out and get the crackling.
Yeah, crisp everything up. I can try that if I, you know, a spare, you know, 14 hours in my oven. Sure, I think I'll just come and keep ordering them. Too much work. You guys really do. Everything, like, it seems like, you know, most things in-house, you know, pretzel, sausage, just, you know, everything is being, bread, baked. Is that...
Well, one of the things I inherited when I walked into Paulana the first time, of course, I did a tour through the bar, through the dining room, the private dining room, and then I opened the door, and there was the kitchen, and I was blown away. I mean, I'm working here in New York in kitchens for 16 years, but I've never seen a kitchen that size.
Well, we should start, like, Paulana is a huge space itself. It is humongous.
Well,
and especially because it's in the Bowery, which, you know, is, you know, downtown Manhattan is just, you know, spaces were always smaller and a little, you know, eclectic feeling. And you walk into this, and it's a pretty massive space. It's not imposing, you know, it feels really warm, but it's just... For New York, so much space. And then I guess
especially for the Lower East Side, where most restaurants have like 50, 60 seats, and we have a 260 seat capacity. So you walk into this place, and you the first thing you see are the copper tanks where the brewmaster brews the beer, and then you see the tanks behind the bar. One of the things we do, the beer comes straight out of the tank into the glass. We don't bottle anything. We don't put anything in kegs. So it's brewed. It goes into the fermentation room, stays there for 2 to 4 weeks, and then is pumped into the tank, which feeds the bar.
Huh.
So it can't be any fresher than that.
Yeah. Is it still fermenting then in the tank, I guess, I would imagine? Or is it, I guess...
No, I think...
How do you do that? You get rid of the yeast. You would just have to filter it out?
No, we don't.
Not filtered?
It's completely unfiltered and completely unstabilized. This is something we're very proud of. We do not touch anything. It's four ingredients, water, malt, hops, and yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fermented, and we decided we're going to keep it as is. So I would say for the first 4 to 5 days, it's actually pretty cloudy. Sometimes we have complaints about that. Oh, the beer is not clear. But this is really what we wanted to.
Yeah.
Because it really shows the full flavor. And after a couple of days, the yeast kind of like...
Everything kind of comes out of suspension, settles out.
Yeah, it settles on the bottom, and so the beer is getting clearer then.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's amazing to think, you know, just that it could be that fresh. I had never really considered, you know, is beer unadulterated or what's going on after it ferments, but I guess you...
Well, one of the beautiful things of that is that since there are no additives or stabilizations, you actually don't get a headache. I mean, if you have too much beer from Paulana, you actually feel kind of tired the next day, but you never will have a headache.
We ran into Falco and Pete when we were at Paulana on Friday, and so I had a beautiful meal, you know, flight of beers, getting ready to leave, run into friends like a booth over, and they're playing. Do you know the game Eyes?
No.
Okay, so you guys have like the big leader glasses, you know,
yes,
with the little, you know, kind of like cutouts, those round, you know,
right,
cutouts, dimples going, you know, circling the glass and going up vertically. And so they have leader glasses. And someone, when you pick up your beer, you commit to drinking. You have to drink from one of those
eyes to the next.
And if once you pick up your glass, you commit everyone else, and they have to do theirs. I don't really know the point of the game beyond that. I don't think there was a winner or a loser. I think everyone's winning. But I...
As long as they can drink.
As long as they can drink. So I accidentally sat down into that game for a few rounds. And I woke up feeling fantastic the next day. I guess that's...
You see, it's all natural.
I remarked the next day, I couldn't believe, like, I wasn't hungover at all. I would never have thought it was what I was drinking. I just thought I was, like, a champion. I'm like, you know, I'm not that old yet. I can still do this. Maybe it works.
I tried it a couple of times, and it always worked.
Just a couple of times, sure.
Just a couple of times.
I want to get back to talking about the actual like kitchen space and what you guys are you know, baking and making in there. Because you were saying the kitchen is just, you know, expansive, you know, having room for production.
So you've seen our dining room. It's I think that the size is about 2.5 to 3,000 square feet. And the kitchen is actually the same size. It's just like one floor below. So the first time I walked into this kitchen, I was like, wow, the dishwashing area is usually the size of the kitchen I was working in. And now here it is. This is just a room for the dishwasher.
That's like five of my apartments. And I live with two other people.
Exactly. So I just saw there was everything there, like all those different stations, the hot station, the cold station, the prep station, the big pastry station, one of the things which was not there, which I created, was the butcher station, which also became the sausage making station. So with all that room, I said, well, why would we actually purchase anything? We have everything there already, so we should start making everything on our own. So we spent 2 months trying to figure out how to make the best sausages, how to make pretzel, how to make bread. And obviously we had friends in the industry who came in and helped us with certain things. And we started developing our own recipes, and here we are.
Is that something that makes financial sense, you know, with the restaurant?
Absolutely.
Really?
I mean, first of all, like the time we are living right now, we try to be less wasteful than we used to be in the 80s, for instance. So we don't want to waste anything from if we get like a whole animal or if we get like a half a pig, we can actually butcher it down. We can use the bones for stocks. We can use the skin for chips. We can use certain parts and make sausages. And it absolutely makes sense. And I think if you try our sausages, you also see that since we're doing small batches, we can also emulsify the fat much, much nicer, which creates a much fluffier consistency of the actual sausages. Some customers find it a little bit weird and artificial.
I will say it was very traditional. It was really good, and I like an emulsified sausage, which is really, you know, a grand hot dog, you know, which is one of my favorite foods. It was light, like the casing was nice. It really did have like a light texture, like it wasn't heavy, I guess would be, you know, what I'm searching for, which was surprising because, like, you know, sausage is a pretty, you know, heavy dish, but it was
well, I find it less tense since everything is becoming once. You don't have the ground meats and then the fat kind of in between. And sometimes the industrial produced sausages, when you cut in, you have the fat coming out already. This is not the case with the sausages we are making. And obviously it takes much longer and there's much more freezing involved because you never want to overheat the fat, because if you do that in the production, then you cannot really emulsify it.
Do you guys have more regulation since you're doing, you know, more in-house baking, or... I'm curious. I'm always in this operational stuff. I guess you're not curing, so it's a little bit different.
It's everything is freshly made on a daily basis, and everything is good.
Cool. I always wonder, like New York City, man, they are so difficult with the regulations sometimes. We were talking about it on another show. They want to force all fish to be frozen once before it's, you know, delivered to a restaurant, and that includes sushi grade fish, like
well,
fish.
I think they have to do it already for sushi restaurants, as far as I know. Every fish which is sushi grade fish or used for sushi has to be frozen, and I think what they do these days is like super freezing, where they bring it down to like minus, I think, 80 degrees Celsius. Don't ask me how much Fahrenheit that is, but it's really cold and it's really hard to get it down there.
Yeah.
But that really stops any
bacteria. It kills it. Yeah. It's like trichinosis-free pork that they do, which is like this deep freezing process, you know, to get rid of anything. But there hasn't been trichinosis in pork in like 70 years. And we're still, you know, worried about doing this for charcuterie programs. Only America is like this sterile,
right?
But it ends up killing the restaurants. I mean, one, it affects the food because you can't, you know, get those, you know, flavors, that those kind of funky flavors that you're looking for, and then, like, you know, to, you know, affect the distributor and the chef and make them, you know, jump through these hoops.
Yeah, it's, I don't really want to talk about it.
you're like, I'm over it. Yeah.
I have my hardship with that. But coming from Europe and where people are able to just do whatever they want, and here there are a lot of regulations where it doesn't really make sense. It's more that they don't understand what's going on, so let's not allow it because there could be something wrong with it.
That's, yeah, I think that's the problem, is not understanding. I don't know. I don't know if we're getting better or worse with it, too. I feel like, you know, food is basically a topic of conversation like it never has been before. It's, you know, especially in the U.S. where it's becoming culturally relevant in a way that's, you know, outside of just the home, people are really starting to revere, you know, become passionate about, you know, food and what they're eating, where it's coming from. So I hope with that we can start being a little bit more adventurous and understanding of, you know, different foods and processes and maybe, you know, go that way. Because it holds a lot of things back. If you don't have freedom to really, like, produce an awesome product, you know, using the ingredients, which can be, you know, time and a little, you know, bit of friendly mold. If you don't have those tools, then, like, you'll never be able to make a product that can compete on, you know, a world market with, you know, other, you know, traditional, you know, cultural, you know, food ways.
Right. Well, I'm talking to a lot of, like, farmers, like small organic farmers and just local farmers in the area. And I kind of have the feeling that there's a huge lobby, the huge corporations, food corporations, and obviously they don't want all those small organic farmers to bring their products to the market, because they know that the product is actually better, it's healthier for people. And so I think a lot of the lawmakers and a lot of the institutions try to slow them down and make it harder for them to actually produce what they're gonna do. And it's sad, but I think more and more people are getting on that wagon, and they like to see more of the healthy stuff and more of the organic and locally grown stuff.
Do you think a restaurant like Polana could have been 10 years ago or 15 years ago? Do you think you guys would have had the, you know, I guess the impetus to, you know, do everything in-house? Because I imagine that, you know, another advantage of doing everything in-house is that you get exactly what you want. And if it's, you know, an ingredient or something that you wouldn't have been able to find.
Well, I think it would have been possible, because with my background, I'm not coming from a city in Austria. I'm coming from the countryside. So I grew up with my family butchering their own pigs and chicken and ducks and geese and whatever was around. And we just, the whole family came together when we slaughtered a pig, and we had to produce, or we had to make something out of it in one day. The blood, we made blood sausage, and we made sausages, and just butchered everything down and froze it away or gave it to the neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so this is just the way I was raised. And in terms of produce, we used whatever was in season. We would never, like, get an asparagus in winter or in fall. Asparagus was a spring vegetable. And so whenever it was available, we really celebrated it, and then it was gone for 9 months of the year.
Until you get a chance to celebrate again.
So if I had the chance, like, 10 years ago, I would have definitely done the same thing already.
Do you think customers would have been behind it, and, you know, public would have? I guess they don't even have to know. It's one of those really interesting spots, or interesting components, I think, makes you know, for a really quality experience. But it's,
well, I think in terms of a beer garden, it's a little bit different, because a beer garden is always very meat centric.
Yeah.
And we really try to introduce vegetarian dishes or fish dishes, and, like, even in summer, and even when women come into the restaurant, they don't really want to. They don't want to go to a beer garden and then have a barley salad, or
yeah,
or just a beet salad. This is like, we are going there, and we want to drink beer, and we want to have a haxen, or we want to have a sausage.
Yeah. Let's go take a quick break, and then we will be back.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to the main course. We have Wolfgang Bonn in studio from Polaner, and we were just talking about beers and brats and everything else beer garden related. So
all the good stuff.
all the good stuff in one. How long have you been in New York?
I'm here for over 15 years now. I came early 2000, and I started off as a private chef for the Austrian UN ambassador, believe it
really?
Or not.
Really?
Yeah. That was my start.
Everyone has to get here somehow. That's not the worst. That's not the worst way to come.
As a diplomatic package, it's easier to come to the country.
Did you have diplomatic immunity? Did you
No.
to ride around with the little flags? Sometimes, maybe.
Sometimes I could use the driver to go shopping, but that was very rarely.
cut in line. It's like, I've got important places to be. So you came here, and then did... You liked it, you wanted to stay, or you couldn't leave? what happens that traps you from the Austrian countryside then to Manhattan?
I was chained to the kitchen. No, just kidding. I remember my first time being in the plane, approaching New York City, and I looked down from the plane, from the window, and I'm like, wow. This is super exciting. One day, I hope I can have my own restaurant in this city. And then I got to know the city, and I got to know the people, and it was super exciting. And through the United Nations, through the diplomatic corps, I got to meet a lot of interesting people. Politics, culture, industry, of course. So this is how I met my first investors, and... got to know them over the years, cooked for them many, many times, and that's basically how we founded our first restaurant.
What was the first spot in New York?
Well, the very first thing we did was after I cooked for the Austrian ambassador.
After they undid the chain
after
and let you
the
out
chain.
Of the basement.
I actually moved to the German embassy and operated their in-house restaurant there.
Oh wow! So you're
my
just
business partner,
around.
Yeah, my business partner Eddie and I, we are doing that now for 15 years, and then we started a small catering company because we wanted to do the same service for other ambassadors and other countries, and a couple of years into, we actually found a spot on 58th Street, and that turned into seasonal.
Was that did you? Think that was there a lack of
of Austrians?
Yeah, no, I mean of the food and of the food culture. Was it not in the city? Because New York is known for having every cuisine. But I mean, if you guys are going out and starting a catering company, I imagine there was an opportunity there to do something.
Yeah, there was definitely opportunity because most ambassadors or most countries they had some housekeepers, and the housekeepers would also like prepare the dishes for. Their official dinners or lunches. So we actually saw a market there and we got into that, and we were price conscious, we were fresh, and obviously two trained chefs could do a little bit more than a housekeeper from somewhere around the world.
So you were running unopposed.
And then with seasonal, we just saw an opportunity. There are like tons of Italian, French, Japanese, Chinese restaurants around, but there were not that many Austrian restaurants. And we thought something seasonally prepared, something which changes throughout the season, was definitely something New York was looking for. And
I was thinking about that this morning, how bizarre it is to think that even just like 5-10 years ago... a menu being seasonal was not intuitively just how it was anyway. Like, right. We had to move back towards seasonal food. Seasonal, was that, did that get a Michelin star?
Yeah, we got the Michelin star the first year we opened.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that was...
That's exciting.
Oh, it was super exciting.
I mean, congrats on
thank you so
first
much.
Year.
We,
first spot.
We opened in a very difficult time. We opened in 2008, or end of 2007. So there was just the start of the financial crisis, and all the media was talking about restaurants closing, and nobody really was talking about new restaurants opening.
Yeah.
And so it took us a while to bring some people into the restaurant, and we changed the direction a little bit, and then we got New York Magazine gave us a 3-star review, and a couple of months later we got a Michelin star, and that obviously helped us a lot to survive and bring people into the doors.
Someone noticed.
Yeah.
Was the next spot after that, was that Eddie and the
that
Wolf?
That was Eddie and the Wolf, yes.
And that's wine focused, or it has, is that with a more of a wine program?
Exactly. Well, the concept of Eddie and the Wolf was a mixture of a Heuriger, which is a rustic Viennese wine tavern, mixed with a ski hut. So when you go in there, there's a lot of warmth, there's a lot of decoration, and rustic tables, communal tables as well. And we never put a sign outside. And once we opened the door, people were just curious, what's going on in here? And they stuck their heads in. And the price point at Eddie and the Wolf is always lower. So it's really something for the neighborhood. And... yeah, I think we're open now for over 5 years, and it's going very well.
That's always, you know, I hear from a lot of different chefs, they talk about, you know, for the neighborhood, for the community, you know, when discussing the price point of a menu. It's nice because it's, I'm sure for you, it's exciting and interesting to be able to do something, you know, really decadent and fine and over the top and just, you know, sky's the limit. But when it comes down to it, you know, we're still in New York. These are neighborhoods and communities. You have to feed and support the people that you're neighboring with. Just being
right.
able to offer them something.
Well, I think with most chefs, it's in the beginning you wanna be very creative, and you wanna do something very extravagant, and but at the end of the day, you're cooking more for yourself and for other chefs.
Yeah.
And not so much for people, because most fine dining restaurants these days, they're just overcomplicated, and it's too much for a regular customer.
Yeah.
And so that's why we decided with our second project, we want to do something which is much more simpler. We showed already that we are able to cook, we are able to maintain quality, but now we want to bring that down and really just be open for everybody. Lower price point, and just a fun restaurant.
That's nice. I feel like you do kind of tend that way. It is when you go into those fine dining places, or I mean, not all of them, but you know, the over the top places. It's for other chefs. It's for ego, and it's creative and interesting and art. But is it a daily, you know, meal? No, probably not. You know, you'd end up with gout or some other. although I'm not, I could probably eat a pork hock a day and get gout too.
Well, I think I still enjoy it. I love to go to like high-end restaurants.
Of course.
And, I mean, the food is amazing, and the artistry behind it. And this is what a lot of people do not even understand, how much work and how much finesse and technique goes into all those dishes. And so I do appreciate that once in a while, but not on a daily basis.
Yeah. No, I mean, we all like going out and having nice things. I complain to my friends, I think they hate me for it, that I'm, you know, just like over fine service and being, you know, taken care of, because I'll go out to a restaurant and, you know, with friends, or, you know, when you're in the industry, when you just... You know, people, things get sent out to you, and then it ends up being like, oh, I just wanted a simple meal, and, you know, there's, like, just everything is, like, too rich and too decadent, and you know, the servers are with their serviettes, and everyone is very upright and polite, and I'm like, I just want to eat with my fingers and just, like, have a regular person meal, and I make that complaint, and they're like, shut up, that's not a thing. Oh, it's too nice.
Like, yeah. Sometimes I have this problem just going to visit a friend, sitting at the bar, and he's like, can I send you a dish? I'm like, just one little one. And then 2 hours later, seven courses later.
You can't move.
I have to go for 2 hour run in the morning.
Yeah, just, you know, as long as it's equivalent the time that you're sitting down for the meal. I don't know. I haven't figured out a way to work. A lot of steps, walk home. It's like, you know, screw the subway. Like, this one, we need to hoof it.
Well, that sometimes doesn't do it. Sometimes you need to do a little more than that.
So this is exciting. With Paul Anner now, is this your focus for the moment? Is this just like what you want to be, or is your mind already wandering to the next thing?
My mind is always wandering. Yeah, I mean, Polana is fun, and Polana is great so far, and I'm definitely continue focusing on that. But I'm always keeping my eyes open for a new opportunity. Maybe. There are a lot of other areas in the city and new places which are just about to develop, and I would love to do something else, somewhere else.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Main Course. If you guys are interested in checking out any of Wolfgang's food, you can stop by Polana and the Bowery. It's on, was it Houston and Bowery?
It's on Bowery between Houston and Stanton. 265 Bowery is the exact address.
Yeah. Check it out. Enjoy some beer. Know that it is hangover free. And yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Yeah, happy Sunday, guys.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.